We would argue that everybody can be creative, but people are going to be creative in different ways. And one of the really cool things about creativity that people forget is that creativity is context specific. So what it means to be creative in one job, it can be very different than being creative in another job. If you think about creativity along a continuum, sometimes what is very creative is a little tweak. It's a change to what you do. Some research I have with Nora looks at a large supermarket chain, and people in the bakery decided that instead of keeping them in a bin, they would design a pegboard to put their cake toppers on. Now, we're sitting here going, well, that's not that creative. But it actually meant that when they came to have to decorate a cake, they could see exactly what cake toppers were available, use those cake toppers and not have to express order them in. And it really helped the bottom line for the bakery. The other work that I do looks at the interplay between creativity and standardization. And so all the research here shows that teams and individuals who are highly creative actually have better performance. The trade-off is, though, teams that are very standardized and follow set procedures often have better customer satisfaction. So think about that. You go to get your car serviced and they give you that 9-point checklist. That's a standardization. You like that. But if they said to you, oh, while you were here, we took the tires off, you know, we looked in the trunk, you'd say, well, you're changing my oil. But they may know that something to do with tire alignment is actually going to help your car's performance. So as customers, we don't always like the creative bit. So here's where it gets really interesting, in my opinion. When you have high creativity and high standardization, that's when you get the best customer satisfaction. For performance, too much standardization and not enough creativity can be detrimental to performance. So again, think about that from a managerial trade-off. How do we encourage people to try new things, like rearrange their cake toppers, because that's going to help their performance. But if we also have some sort of standardization that when you put in your order, you fill out this form, and then when they give you back the cake, they give you back your form. Now you're satisfied and we've got creativity. We're going to have the win-win.
That's cool. They almost sound diametrically opposed, mm-hmm. but they can work hand in hand.
So that's the one end of the continuum, right, where we have this incremental, these tweaks. And at the same time, you need people who are coming up with brand new products, completely new ways of doing things. Think entrepreneurs, think R&D, think communications, marketing teams, right? And so there has to be this blend. And then what we find in our work is different levers, if you like, will influence both. So rewards is always a classic thing. Rewards will get you the incremental. So if I offer a reward, as the supermarket chain did, for people to come up with creative ideas in their work areas, they got lots of tweaks, lots of little things that helped their bottom line, very successful. But we don't come up with the big ideas for the reward. We come up with the big ideas because we're intrinsically motivated, mm-hmm. we're excited about the project. And it works the same way with managers, right? So being hands-on as a manager will help with the incremental. Hands-off as a manager helps with the more radical.
Interesting. I remember this from class.
Yay. Yay, that my job is complete.
You also focus on teams, and a lot of us have to work in teams, whether it's all the time or for certain projects. What should people listening to this know about effective teamwork?
This is like a 10-minute little segment as opposed to a full semester's course on this. A lot of that depends on how your team is working together. So for virtual teams, we know that meeting at least once face-to-face helps team performance. So people often work in virtual teams and, you know, it's the new thing. We have this great technology. And then they're surprised when their team doesn't do as well as expected. And so again, there are a couple of things that the research says will help you. So one is meeting at least once face to face. The other thing is actually getting to know the people on your team, spending some time building trust, building rapport with your teammates. So one of the reasons that virtual teams often don't do as well is that it becomes transactional. Mm-hmm. I go in, do my piece of work, upload it to the cloud, and I leave. Now, when the work becomes more complex, you don't know me. And so you don't know if I just did a bad job, or if that's all I can do. The quality of the work goes down. So a couple of things. So one is getting to know people on the team helps. But the other thing that we find is the role of professional familiarity. So knowing things about the person's work background, work expertise really helps you on a virtual team. So again, managers thinking about levers. Does everybody on the team know their backgrounds? What projects have you worked on before? Maybe share your resume. In regular teams, we call this transactive memory. On a team, you don't have to know everything, right? That's the benefit of a team. You can have experts who come in and know their piece. However, you have to know who knows what. So that piece, transactive memory, is critical here, even more so in virtual teams where I can't ask you a water cooler chat. So from a management perspective, realizing that the more team members know about the expertise of other members, especially if they don't see each other, they may never meet, is going to help team performance, and in particular when tasks get complex. So that's, I think, a critical piece when it comes to business research. A lot of people say to us, you don't do real research in the business school. You're not curing cancer, right? You're not helping, you know, a plane stay in the air. And so I push back on that a lot.
As you should.
Thank you. And argue that, yes, but what we look at is, so, you know, we have a professor, John Matthew, who is looking at what combinations of people should go to Mars. What does the team relationship look like in that type of scenario? John and I have also done work on virtual teams and leadership and how the Army should communicate using technology when something bad happens. So right now, when something bad happens, they shut down all technological communications. Well, guess what? Now everybody knows something bad has happened. And the scope, again, thinking almost like radical to incremental, it could be something disastrous bad has happened or something very small, but everybody assumes the worst. So how can we train their leaders on how to use technology and the appropriate technologies for the right message? Because that's another piece in the virtual teams literature, is varying the technology we use based on the task. So that's just how some of my research ties into business. But, you know, our finance professors are looking at corporate CFOs and their investment strategies, and again, how, you know, different types of investment portfolios will help firms' success under different economic climates. So is that curing cancer? Maybe not. But is that helping the business world succeed? Absolutely. And so that is, again, in my new role, one of my goals is to help, how do we get that message out? How do we share the impact that our research makes to the business community?
Shifting gears a little bit, you champion women in business. In part, you're a faculty advisor for the Women's MBA Association here and in lots of other less formal ways. And you've been in the business world for a long time. So I was curious about what you've learned being a woman in what was kind of traditionally a male-dominated field and how you've made your voice heard and gotten to where you are.
So I will take objection to the word traditionally, because I think it still is a male.
Still, yes.
unfortunately, I think it still is a male-dominated field. So I think there's a lot we can do, and I think a lot of it is we're doing some really good things at the university at the moment. A lot of it is mentoring. A lot of it is women's support groups. So I've been very fortunate in my career that I've had some amazing women mentors who have helped me with some decisions and said, do this, don't do that, speak up now. Don't speak up now. But the flip side of mentoring is sponsors and advocates. So people who are maybe in the proverbial room where it happens, who will put your name forward and support you. I coach a lot of young women on come in and sit down. Don't sit in the corner. Don't sit on the back side of the room. Own your space. And if you have an opinion, speak up. If it's not correct, somebody will correct you, but that's okay. And then there's a lot of research, which I think is super cool, on what's called amplification. And that's the role that those of us who are more senior in our career can really play, which is we know that the way women speak, they often inflect, because women talk to build collaboration, whereas men often talk to compete and to win. So when you hear a woman mention something in a meeting and she inflects at the end, it's not so much that she doesn't know the answer. She's trying to get buy-in from the group. So then the research shows that, you know, three or four suggestions later, a man makes the same suggestion without inflecting, and the outcome gets attributed to him. So what women can do is go back and say, I'd like to comment on what Julie said, or Julie's point was. So how do we make sure that we are crediting the person who said it originally by using their name? The other piece, sometimes with unconscious bias, is the research here says that it's unconscious. We don't necessarily know we're doing it. So women have to realize that, rather than sort of going away and feeling, oh, that didn't go the way I wanted. Sometimes if you're talking to a man or a group of men, say, listen, I know you may not like me for asking for this, but if I didn't ask for this, I wouldn't be doing my job, supporting my team, asking for something that a male colleague would ask. Now that you have referenced the unconscious bias up front, to some degree, you've sort of closed that door a little bit. So, you know, helping women see, you can ask for it, you know, what are your strategies? I work a lot with the undergrads. I just spoke at the Women in Business Club last week, saying, you get a job offer, ask for more. This is where being in a business school is so cool because you can do the financial implications. So the man gets a $5,000 salary offer that's higher than yours. What does that end up translating to over a lifetime? Yeah. So the first $5,000 is maybe, you know, the down payment on your car. The second $5,000 plus the salary increase is your vacation, you know, and it just compounds. So one of the things that doesn't matter how busy I am, I will probably always meet with women students and talk at women's groups. It's that building the cohort, building the group, helping one another. How can we all help each other? The generation before us, they were sort of the first women out there and they had to sort of play the men's game. I think our generation, we have women ahead of us, and now we have to step up and support the next generation.